is Monday, February 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was acquitted Saturday of inciting an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. How are Americans reacting?
Everything he's been doing is trying to ruin the very fragile voting system we already have.
He is no longer in his office.
Plus, new COVID-19 cases in New Zealand prompt new lockdowns, and Valentine's Day may have passed, but we have some romantic tunes to start your week. We'll have these stories and more next. A big cleanup has kicked off throughout northeastern Japan as residents pick up debris following a strong earthquake that struck on Saturday. AP correspondent Karen Chamas is up first.
The 7.3 magnitude quake set off a landslide on a highway, damaged buildings and train lines, as well as causing power blackouts for thousands of people. The quake-prone areas of Fukushima and Miyagi shook, causing concern of another tsunami which 10 years earlier caused a meltdown at Fukushima's nuclear power plant. Luckily, there were no tsunamis and no reports of radiation leaks. More than 140 people suffered mostly minor injuries, many of them by falling objects and cuts while stepping on broken glass. One man filmed his bathwater sloshing frantically, exclaiming, "This is not good. Being hit by an earthquake when I am taking a bath is not good. This is a big one." I'm Karen Chamas.
The United States Senate on Saturday acquitted former President Donald Trump of the impeachment charge that he incited the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol. By a vote of 57 to 43, senators voted not to hold Trump responsible for his supporters' attempts to overturn the counting of Electoral College results for Democrat Joe Biden. Seven Republicans voted with Democrats for Trump's conviction, 10 short of the 67 total needed. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the acquittal of former President Donald Trump a vote of infamy.
This was about choosing country over Donald Trump. And 43 Republican members chose Trump. They chose Trump.
While U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called Donald Trump practically and morally responsible for his supporters' deadly attack on the Capitol, he voted to acquit the former president.
If President Trump were still in office, I would have carefully considered whether the House managers proved their specific charge. By the strict criminal standard, the president's speech probably was not incitement. However, in the context of impeachment, the Senate might have decided this was acceptable shorthand for the reckless actions that preceded the riot. But in this case, the question is moot because former President Trump is constitutionally not eligible for conviction.
But at the onset of the impeachment trial, a majority of the Senate voted to proceed with the hearing. To explore the constitutional limits of the U.S. impeachment process, I spoke with Joe Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law.
Well, first of all, Mitch McConnell's argument that he thought the trial was unconstitutional because it took place after the president left office, since it was Mitch McConnell's decision not to allow the trial to take place when the president was still in office. The Senate rules prescribe that as soon as the articles of impeachment are delivered to the Senate, the trial must commence the following day at 1 p.m. So the delay that took place was entirely within McConnell's control. Second, the Constitution doesn't really prescribe anything about what the jurors must do, but the jurors are required to take an oath that says that they will be an impartial jury. And I think it's a fair question to ask whether members of the Senate who collaborated with the president's defense team could really be regarded as impartial jurors. But I think the more fundamental question here is really whether it was unconstitutional. The Constitution was framed at a time when the British Parliament was in the process of impeaching Warren Hastings for having committed maladministration when he was the governor general of India. But Warren Hastings had retired 2 years earlier. The British Parliament had no problems with impeaching retired or former officials. In fact, they had done it many times.
House impeachment managers said that the trial was necessary because if a conviction was awarded during the Senate trial, it would trigger a second vote on the former president's ability to hold future office. But I want to ask you this. The 14th Amendment says something similar, that no one can hold a significant role in government if they've engaged in insurrection or rebellion. And I wanted to ask you, you know, constitutionally, you know, what is the difference between going down the 14th Amendment road versus impeachment?
That's a great question. The Senate only, of course, has the power over impeachment. It can't decide to convict him of the crime of insurrection or of citing the insurrection. So we will have to wait and see what the courts do in this case. I do think that there's a possibility that if Congress were to pass a censure motion saying that the president was being censured for having incited the insurrection, some court might regard that as sufficient evidence to use to block the president from ever having his name again on a ballot in any state.
And while the impeachment trial of former President Trump has concluded, there are other potential legal challenges ahead.
The president's legal problems are just beginning. The fact is that the president has not been able to retain good lawyers any longer because of his failure to pay his attorneys and the fact that he has been so disparaging of all the people who work for him. So how is he going to defend himself with the criminal and civil cases that are now being investigated and may be filed soon in the District of Columbia, Atlanta, Georgia, New York, and possibly elsewhere? I just think the president is going to have his hands full for a very long time.
Joel Paul is a constitutional law professor at the UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, California. Following the acquittal on Saturday of former President Trump in his second impeachment trial, Trump's future in politics remains uncertain. Michael Sullivan reports that Republicans and Democrats face separate challenges in the post-Trump era.
Trump was found not guilty of inciting violence against the U.S. government after his supporters stormed Congress January 6th, enraged by Trump's false charge that Joe Biden stole the election. Democrats said Trump's responsibility was clear. Seven Republicans agreed, but others said there was not enough evidence. A Reuters Ipsos poll shows 71% of U.S. adults and half of Republicans believe Trump is partly responsible for the riots. This man named Zach supported impeachment.
Everything he's been doing is trying to ruin the very fragile voting system we already have that's already been beaten down quite a bit.
A Trump supporter, Shel Reines, said Congress was wasting its time.
Impeachment is to remove a president, a sitting president, from his office. He is no longer in his office.
Surveys show most Republicans still embrace Trump. Barbara Perry is an analyst at the University of Virginia.
In fact, 70% of Republicans believe that Joe Biden was a legally elected president.
Something Republican leaders admit is false. But the analyst says Trump supporters got the policies they wanted.
They got lower taxes, fewer regulations, conservatives on the federal bench, conservatives on the Supreme Court.
An aggressive foreign policy and hard line on border issues. President Joe Biden and Democrats in Congress face challenges. Analyst Elaine Kmark of the Brookings Institution.
The Democrats need to get us out of COVID and get the economy back on track. They've got a pretty straightforward job to do, and whatever ideological divisions there are in the party, they are muted compared to the Republican Party.
Trump is loved by his base, but reviled by some Republicans and only tolerated by others. Kmark and her colleagues at the Brookings Institution foresee a range of possible futures for Trump.
It goes all the way from leading the Republican Party and getting reelected as president in 2024 to going to jail. or having to go into exile in Russia or Saudi Arabia or someplace like that.
Exonerated in Congress, Trump remains a target for many prosecutors over his business dealings. Kmark says the man who defied expectations of presidential behavior may be the most unconventional former president. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol has prompted new life into a long-running discussion among government policymakers over whether the United States needs a new domestic terrorism law. White House correspondent Patsy Wittig-Aswara takes it from here.
Democrats underscored the rising threat of domestic terrorism during former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial following the January 6th deadly siege of the Capitol. Democratic Congresswoman Diana DeGette.
Our intelligence agencies confirmed that in addition to these specific threats, President Trump's conduct emboldened the very same violent groups who initiated the attack and sparked new violent coalitions.
Hundreds have been charged for their role in the riot, including for violent entry and disorderly conduct and assaulting law enforcement officers. But none have been slapped with domestic terrorism charges, as there is no specific law that penalizes it. Connor Eldridge is a former U.S. attorney and federal prosecutor.
That's a good debate we should have in the Congress. But right now, we've got to focus on the laws we do have on the books and the existing laws we have, the many laws that have been used to prosecute the people who committed insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. Those laws are sufficient, whether they be murder or bombing or those explosive type laws, whether they be gun laws.
Following the September 11th attacks, the U.S. strengthened laws and improved mechanisms for intelligence gathering and sharing to deter foreign threats. Days after taking office, President Joe Biden directed a review to better address domestic violent extremism.
Well, the review is a 100-day review, so there's not an update on that quite yet. Once we have a conclusion, I'm sure we will reveal the specifics to all of you.
Excessive surveillance of Muslim communities after 9/11 has underscored one of the challenges in responding to terror threats, how to avoid government overreach and strike the right balance between security concerns and civil liberties. Faiza Patel is co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program.
That we, A, make sure that we don't go so broad that we sweep in all kinds of activity that we don't need to sweep in, and B, that our strategies are really kind of clearly targeted at the kinds of violence that we really want to reach.
Americans' right to join hate groups like the Proud Boys and the Ku Klux Klan is considered protected freedom of speech and assembly under the First Amendment. Patsy Wittig-Aswara, VOA News at the White House.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the American Heart Association, the health term heart failure doesn't mean a person's heart has completely stopped working, but that a patient's heart isn't pumping as well as it should be. They add, if the heart isn't pumping properly, the body's cells can't be sufficiently nourished to ensure a properly functioning body. A new study in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology finds that globally, the number of heart failure patients almost doubled from 33.5 million in 1990 to 64.3 million in 2017. To reach their findings, researchers analyzed data gathered in a study that included patients in 195 nations. The study found while heart failure rates dropped in more developed countries over the span of the study, they increased in less developed nations. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Residents in Yangon, Myanmar patrolled the city in groups overnight, fearful of police arrest raids and criminals they say have been released by the military to stoke unrest. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
At a Yangon pagoda, four suspected ex-criminals lie tied up on the ground. They were caught overnight by residents in the Sanchang neighborhood, who fear Myanmar's military released them to cause trouble. Worries about criminal activity have increased since Friday, when the junta announced it would free 23,000 prisoners. They said the move was consistent with establishing a new democratic state with peace development and discipline. But unverified pictures on social media have fueled rumors that criminals are trying to stir unrest by setting fires or poisoning water supplies. Tin Mient, who was among the crowds that detained the men in Sanchang, cited pro-democracy protests in 1988, when the military was widely accused of releasing criminals to stage attacks.
We think the military intends to cause violence with these criminals by getting them to infiltrate the peaceful protests. Then the military will have a reason to extend their power to crack down on violence.
The four men were handed over to the police. The government and the army could not be reached for comment. This is just one episode from a night in which residents patrolled together, fearful of attacks and arrest raids by police. But despite their worries, people were once again out in force on Sunday. From thousands marching in Yangon and convoys of motorbikes in the capital, Naypyidaw, to drumming in the coastal southeastern town of Dawe and flag-waving and revolutionary songs in Wai Mor, in the mountainous far northern Kachin. One common thread across those protests, the face of Aung San Suu Kyi. Her detention on charges of importing walkie-talkies is due to expire on Monday. Her lawyer could not be reached for comment on what was set to happen.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. In a Sunday statement, the United Nations Secretary General said he is deeply concerned about the situation in Myanmar, including the increasing use of force and the reported deployment of additional armored vehicles to major cities. Antonio Guterres called on Myanmar's military and police to ensure the right of peaceful assembly is fully respected and that demonstrators are not subjected to reprisals. The Secretary General added, reports of continued violence, intimidation, and harassment by security personnel are unacceptable. After a winter surge, coronavirus cases continue to decline in the United States, and the AP's Ben Thomas has more.
Researchers at Johns Hopkins University say the seven-day average of new COVID-19 cases dropped below 100,000 on Friday, the first time since early November, and it stayed below 100,000 this weekend. However, the impact of the winter surge continues to play out. The number of Americans who have died of infections is now more than 484,000, another 3,000 plus in the past 24 hours. That after more than 5,400 deaths were registered in the previous 24 hours. I'm Ben Thomas.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has announced that the city of Auckland will enter a three-day lockdown period from Sunday after New Zealand recorded its first cases of COVID-19 since late January. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has the details.
Ardern said level three restrictions will require everyone to stay at home except for essential shopping and essential work.
3 days, though, should give us enough time to gather further information, undertake large-scale testing, and establish if there has been wider community transmission. That is what we believe the cautious approach requires and is the right thing to do.
She went on to tell the news conference in Wellington, quote, "We've stamped out this virus before and we will do it again." Sunday's cases were traced back to a couple and their daughter in Auckland. Health authorities are trying to find out whether they involve any of the new highly infectious variants that have been found in other countries, including the UK and South Africa. The COVID-19 alert for the rest of New Zealand was raised to level two, with all gatherings limited to 100 people, including at restaurants and cafes. The country is due to start inoculating its population of 5 million with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine from next Saturday.
Reuters' Adam Reed. India's nationwide vaccination drive against COVID-19 is picking up speed after encountering vaccine hesitancy in a country where the pandemic has waned. Anjana Pasricha visited an inoculation center in a New Delhi hospital to see the hurdles and the progress in India's drive, which it has billed as the world's largest.
A sense of apprehension, then a sense of relief, as these health workers at Indraprastha Apollo Hospital in New Delhi received their first vaccine shot against COVID-19.
I heard from so many people that there is lots of side effects, but actually I was a bit worried before I received the vaccine, but I feel good and I'm waiting for the next dose.
I feel very safe because I worked for a long time in a COVID ward. Even if something has happened to me, I will be all right with this vaccine.
After the inoculation, the health workers click photos at a selfie point. Such initiatives are part of a massive drive by officials to persuade people to take the shot in a country battling to overcome vaccine hesitancy. After India rolled out its nationwide vaccination program a month ago, initial reports about possible side effects of vaccines raised doubts among some, even health workers. To ease such worries, doctors are stepping forward to get inoculated.
People were a bit scared, a lot of questions. We kept on answering their questions. And then when they saw that vaccine is quite safe, this helped us in building the confidence in vaccine.
The pace is picking up. Daily numbers of inoculations at this center have increased threefold. That is not the case in some other vaccination centers. The problem is a decreased sense of urgency about getting inoculated as India's case numbers dip dramatically. Markets are buzzing. There are lines outside metro stations. Some are also hesitant to take one of the two vaccines India is using because final trials have not concluded. However, health officials are trying to reinforce the message that only vaccinations will end the pandemic.
The centers where it is not good footfall, there we are a bit too worried. There we are using mobilizers, senior consultants. We are calling them up to see that they get that vaccinated.
The next phase, inoculating those over 50, may pose greater challenges. Even this vulnerable group is divided about taking the shots.
Whenever my turn comes, I will take the vaccination.
Personally, I'll wait and watch because I feel my immunity is okay.
So far, more than 8 million people have been vaccinated. But those numbers will have to be scaled up substantially if India is to meet its target of reaching 300 million people by August. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Officials say heavy fighting between forces of Yemen's internationally recognized government and Houthi rebels raged again Sunday. The fighting took place in the strategic province of Marib and has cast major doubt over UN-led efforts to restart negotiations to end years of civil war. Dozens have been killed. The Iranian-backed rebels earlier this month renewed their attack on the oil-rich province, which is an anti-Houthi stronghold held by the internationally recognized government. Both sides say they faced stiff resistance and have not made progress amid heavy casualties, mostly among the Houthis. And finally, in many countries around the world, and including the United States, Valentine's Day was celebrated on Sunday, February 14th. VOA Music Time in Africa host Heather Maxwell shared with us some music to celebrate the day and start our week.
Love is in the air, and I have the perfect Valentine's music for you. African musicians and music lovers around the world have been sending me in all week their favorite African romantic music videos, along with personal introductions. Here are the top five.
Yes, so my name is Fassi Gadam from Africa, based in Ghana. I want to dedicate this song for my fans across the world.
Everyone, happy Valentine's Day. Our favorite music video is Jusqu'à la Guerre by Daphne. Special shout out to my husband, Tyler. Thank you for everything you do for our family. We love you tons.
This is your boy, LTD, Bulbul from South Sudan. I am here to wish you a happy Valentine. I invite all of you to go and listen to one of my favorite songs. I call it You Are a Queen. Africa, Voice of America, my family, my friend, my super fans around the world. Happy Valentine.
Happy Valentine's, everybody. My name is Kasiva Mutua. I'm a percussionist and drummer from Nairobi, Kenya. I'd love to dedicate a beautiful song by Umu Sangari called Fajamu. Anybody watching all over Africa and all over the world, be kind to each other, love one another, and too much love from Kenya.
What's up, everyone? My name is Oprah Kondos Yungulan from Zalai Shingalengo Sazan Mkavai, all the way from South Africa. I just want to say happy Valentine's Day to everyone and the perfect music video that celebrates love or embraces love to the fullest is a music video by yours truly. Everyone loves love and everyone loves to be loved. So I just want to say happy Valentine's Day to my special someone. I just want to say, yo, I love you. I know you got me, I got you too. And I want to send a special shout out to Music Time in Africa and a special shout out to Voice of America. Like,
you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday in February, Americans honor their leaders of the past by observing President's Day. The commemoration, which today honors all presidents, was originally meant to celebrate George Washington, the first president of the United States. As the leading figure during the American Revolutionary War and the country's first executive, George Washington was immensely popular. He was, and still is, often referred to as the father of the United States. This is partly because he was the military leader credited with the victory of the American colonies over the most powerful army of the time. But he went on to shape the future of the presidency, setting many a precedent for those who would hold the post after him. Washington believed in the necessity of a balance between making the presidency powerful enough to be able to effectively lead a national government, but not so powerful as to mimic the authority of a monarchy. Worried that if he died in office, the public might decide that the presidency was meant to be a lifetime appointment, Washington resigned after two terms. With one exception, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's four terms, every president followed Washington's example of serving no more than two terms in office. In 1951, the U.S. Congress ratified the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which limits the president to two terms in office. President Washington significantly influenced the path for the presidency moving forward. He set standards in all aspects, including political power, military practice, and economic policy. No wonder, then, that beginning in 1800, the year after his death, George Washington's birthday, February 22nd, was unofficially celebrated throughout the new country he helped found. The observance of Washington's birthday formally became a national holiday in 1885. Eventually, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls close to Washington's. Eventually, the third Monday in February became a federal observance day honoring all presidents. The President's Day observance salutes those leaders who had the courage and determination to step into this most difficult of jobs and lead the United States of America in good times and bad. All see and most admire the glare which hovers round the external trappings of elevated office, George Washington once wrote in a letter to a friend. To me, there is nothing in it beyond the luster which may be reflected from its connection with the power of promoting human felicity.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.